A suggestion for great summer reading, Golden Hill, a novel of old New York by Frances Spufford. It is a story of old New York and old England as it takes place 30 years before the Revolution. We meet Englishman Richard Smith, who gets off a ship in New York Harbor and heads onto the streets of 1746 Manhattan, a fortune, a bill for £1,000 in his pocket. But it will take 300 pages of treachery, misunderstandings, adultery, dueling, upset over race relations, over gay relationships, and more to find out who he is, how he got that bill, and what his purpose is. And it's worth the wait. Author Frances Spufford's nonfiction has won several awards. He teaches writing at Goldsmiths College in London and joins us from the BBC studios in Cambridge for a closer look at this, his first and terrific novel, Golden Hill. Frances, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thank you for having me.
I just loved this, in part because my people, the Dutch, were the first settlers of New York, and they are very much in your novel. But do us a favor and set the scene, because, you know, Americans tend to think of our history in sort of a truncated version. You know, the Puritans came, there was the Mayflower, we met the Native Americans. We then overthrew the British, and now we have the 4th of July.
Yeah.
So you are in a pocket before all that happened. Tell us about 1746 Manhattan. What's going on?
Well, it's a generation before the American Revolution, and nobody knows it's coming. And I wanted to get the reader back into that state of perception where the colonists are rehearsing the themes that are going to be big in the American Revolution in a generation's time, but still think of themselves as extremely loyal and rather royalist as well. The cities are tiny, and New York is no exception. There are only about 7,000 people in it. It's a little town right down at the southern tip of Manhattan Island. It runs out more or less where Brooklyn Bridge is now, and it makes its living, strangely enough, selling flour and dried peas to the sugar plantations down in the Caribbean. And it sells rum all the way to Philadelphia in one direction and all the way to Boston the other way. It's a rum city.
Well, tell us more about the tensions. Although the Dutch were replaced by the English in running the city, they're still very much there. Both the Dutch and the English Protestants scorn the French. Tell us a little more about what's going on.
This was somewhere that was very exclusively Protestant, with a richly developed paranoia directed at Catholics. Boo, evil. And the French, Catholics, therefore evil, and also ruled by an absolute monarch, therefore frightening, the embodiment of all threats to liberty. The population of the city is about half and half Dutch and English at this point, but the Dutch are in the process of losing their language and turning into the oldest layer of New Yorkers, the people who will be Roosevelts and Vanderbilts. And there are also 1,000 or 1,500 slaves in the city. So it's an English-Dutch-African city, and the slaves are fresh from the Middle Passage themselves, so they still speak African languages. They're still on the quiet practicing African religions.
And into this steps our protagonist, Mr. Smith, this young, bright, driven young Londoner. We, the readers and the people in New York, have the same kind of reaction. Who is this guy? New York at this point is, as you said, 7,000 people. They notice every newcomer.
He is an urban animal, and he has no idea how to cope somewhere where everybody knows the last thing you did. He expects people to forget him, instead of which he has entered a kind of tiny soap opera where everybody already knows everybody. And even though he has plans of his own, everybody else has plans too. Mm-hmm. And he's out of his depth,
right,
pretty much from the beginning.
Well, as most people are in New York, it's funny how you could find parallels with the New York we know now with this New York back then.
I wanted you to be able to recognize it at the same time as almost everything was different on the surface. And writing it, you know, you cannot banish the skyscrapers from your imagination. The ghosts of them hang over the tiny cobbled streets of this very small town.
Mm-hmm. A couple of themes that run through your novel also resonate. There's homosexual love. There's race relations. We don't want to give too much away because every page is just a... We don't find out why Mr. Smith is in New York until the very last page. But
no, I've been fiendish that way, I hope.
But we do find out early on that he is mixed race. Nobody in New York knows it. You can't see it, but he is.
He is, in fact, to use a term that wouldn't come along for another century or two, he's passing, and he has very good reasons for doing that. And it means that the book, I hope, is playing a kind of judo move on, at least on its white readers, who might be inclined, as you know, I usually am myself, to think that if race isn't specified as subject matter, it can't be very important. Whereas race is actually filling out continuously the whole of Mr. Smith's experience of New York. He notices the slaves in every room and what he's there for, which I have to be cagey about, turns very strongly on race. I wanted you to be an outsider along with him and also be in the situation of the New Yorkers who are puzzled by him. I wanted to be kind of puzzlement in both directions.
Yeah. So there's the storyline of race. I could not have guessed the ending. But there's also constant commentary on the literature of the day, which, by the way, it doesn't reach New York, you know, for like 2 or 3 years after it's big in London. But they're conscious of that. And in your writing, too, I feel we hear Dickens, Christmas Carol. Could you just read us a little bit?
The snow falling in fat, tumbling clots as if the stuffing of furniture were being tossed over the balconies of heaven only laid a soft, thick dressing atop the ice, smothering the prospect in indistinguishable white on white, except where the Hudson still tore an iron-coloured path out towards the leaden harbour.
Where are we in time when it comes to the great literature?
We're good and early in the history of the novel as a form, which for me was part of the attraction. It seems to me that historical novels miss a trick when they take us time-travelling but keep the language at early 21st century, whereas if you want to get back into the sensibility, you ought to travel into the language as well in some ways. And this is supposed to be not just a novel about the 18th century, but kind of an 18th century novel too, back at the point where the men and women who are inventing it like the language rich and thick. They like ornament, but they also like cheap thrills. They don't yet know what the rules are, so they are throwing together a bunch of things which later on people of good taste will think are completely incompatible with each other, which I thought was a beautiful opportunity to mix up tragedy and comedy and political intrigue and a ballroom scene and a rooftop chase and a bit of surprisingly bone-crunching violence and some quite rude sex, because they aren't Victorian, so they don't know you're not allowed to do that either, and so on and so forth. It's a big string bag of a form where you can put in more or less anything that interests you.
Also, there are scenes, for instance, Smith lands in jail a couple of times, and on one occasion he meets a violent, bawdy inmate who boasts about scapegoating his slave friends for a crime and volunteering to be the one to kill them on a wheel. You know, they're stretched on a wheel. It's brutal. It's, you know, nauseating at times.
It is.
Is it based on real events?
Yes, I'm afraid it is. And I'm afraid the breaking on the wheel done by an amateur is horribly true. There is a kind of easily accessible heart of darkness there in the history of the Enlightenment. You know, people are so proud of their virtues and their liberties, and alongside it runs this deep, dark cruelty. It has to be there in the story to do any kind of justice to the good stuff about the century.
Well, and how did you write it?
Well, for a start, I walked round and round Lower Manhattan with a photocopy of an 18th century street map and reading, but then imagining, because there is nothing left standing of Mr. Smith's version of the city of New York apart from a few gravestones in Trinity Churchyard and the iron railings around the bowling green. But there are surviving prints. There are decorative maps of New York which have little tiny illustrations of the main buildings. And I used novels because it's a great age for kind of babbling human voices in novels, all the way from gutters to palaces, but also law reports, histories, and letters. And beyond a certain point, I'm afraid to say, I just thought, I know what I want to do with this. I don't want more facts. They may get in the way.
The interesting thing is that here you have this glorious novel that's getting rave reviews and inspired, as you've said, by the novels of Henry and Sarah Fielding. And it's a time when people living in that time didn't yet trust novels.
No, it's a time when novels are novel. Proper literature at the time, after all, was written by men who could read Latin and Greek, whereas novels were written by women and journalists and shopkeepers who were good on psychology but rubbish on reading Cicero. And there's something about the kind of flexible lowness of the form which is why it's still alive. Even now, those early novels make a really, really good magnifying glass for looking at the human condition.
Well, I smell TV series, perhaps Masterpiece Theater.
I couldn't possibly comment.
Oh, I knew it.
Something has just started to happen in England, but I must make no assumptions
here.
Oh,
all right. Well, we'll just wait. Francis Bufford, his first novel is Golden Hill, A Novel of Old New York. Thank you so much.
Thanks.